Hello, listeners, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Bad Movie Bunny podcast, where horror and thrillers are reviewed, but it's the next scream that you hear your own. My name is Lisa, or the Bad Movie Bunny, and this episode is part one of a two-part episode. I'm participating in the Horror Gives Back Challenge created by Erica and Lance of the Unsung Horrors podcast, which you can find on many podcasting platforms, as well as Twitter as @UnsungHorrors, and you can find information about the challenge, which is a fundraiser for the Trevor Project. For every movie a participant watches during the month of October, they donate $1 or more. Participants can also post on Twitter with the hashtag HorrorGivesBack along with their movie pick of the day. I will also post a link to the Unsung Horrors Trevor Project fundraising page in the episode description. Now, much like my June Sploitation episodes, I will do a quick review of the movies that I see, and each day is based on a given theme, such as a movie from a specific director, or a sequel, or an animal, though I doubt I will see a movie starring flamingos, those unsung heroes, unsung horrors, and final birds that the genre overlooked. Now, if I'm wrong, and it is streaming, please, please, please let me know immediately. One thing that I will do that is different from June's Sploitation is that I will try to watch movies that I haven't seen before. Now, for this episode, I was successful, and some of my picks coincided with what Erica and Lance picked on Giving Days. I'm looking forward to hearing what they have to say about them. So let's get into it. Day One's theme is Roger Corman, and I chose 1963's The Terror. I remember watching the Roger Corman Little Shop of Horrors from 1960, and it was different from the musical version released years later. I mean, this was pretty cheesy, and I remember a young Jack Nicholson in a brief role where he really liked dentistry. A little too much. Now, this time around, Nicholson has the starring role as a French soldier who gets lost from his unit and finds himself walking along the Baltic Sea until he comes across a beautiful woman played by Sandra Knight. Like many a creepy dude, he follows her, and then she just vanishes as one might. Catching up to her, he reaches a castle and meets an even creepier baron played by Boris Karloff. So, witchcraft base, hilarity, crypt flooding, and bird action ensues. No flamingos, unfortunately. But I tend to have fun with Roger Corman movies, and his take on the gothic, with the terror, was no exception. There was melodrama, costume porn, and color. Lots of color, something no doubt utilized in the trip later on. It's just weird seeing Jack Nicholson so young. Day Two's theme was sequels, and I chose 2006's Final Destination 3. Now, I'd seen the first two movies, but never really bothered with the other sequels. You know, sometimes you power through, sometimes you give up on the franchise. Now, Final Destination has death itself as the villain, and the cast is picked off in ways that can only be described as Rube Goldberg-esque. Well, this was no exception, and the cannon fodder was overall pretty unlikable. But the fun of the third sequel was not the premonition of a plane or auto crash to set it all in motion, but an amusement park thrill ride, that great lawsuit waiting to happen, going awry. If this were made years earlier, they might have been able to film it at Action Park in all its accident-riddled glory. Speaking as one that loves and sometimes fears roller coasters, a vision of a ride accident on a senior class outing preventing a disaster catching the attention of death, it was enjoyable for me. For those who have second thoughts about that first big drop, seeing Mary Elizabeth Winstead's dread at the no turning back after turnstile sign is relatable, even if she gets to be in Birds of Prey later on. I don't know if I will watch the rest of the franchise, but this sequel was fun. It makes you want to hold on to the handles on your safety harness. I just wish the giant devil animatronic voiced by Tony Todd were at my childhood parks. I'll state for the record that after a trip to Universal Studios and a few turns on the Hulk upside down coaster, While chickening out of Rip Ride Rocket with a steep climb and steeper drop, and the 70 miles per hour Velocicoaster, that beginning premonition of the accident stuck with me. Day 3's theme is anthologies, and I chose 1993's Body Bags. I'm not that big a fan of anthology movies, but this was directed by John Carpenter and Tobe Hooper, and the cast looked interesting, and they included Mark Hamill. A lot of the fare involves transplanted body parts taking over the mind, and Robert Carradine playing a serial killer. It was a fun watch with decent performances. Day 4's theme was insects, and I chose 1958's Earth vs. the Spider. What's a horror movie challenge without a creature feature involving giant bugs? Now, I have a thing for Julian Sands, but I didn't go with arachnophobia. I instead took advantage of Tubi's selection of older sci-fi movies for an independent giant spider flick, where, if I am not mistaken, the cave scenes were filmed in Carlsbad, New Mexico. When a man fails to come home, his daughter and her boyfriend go out to look for him, only to find that he was in a rather unusual car accident. For the record, this was the late teen 1950s, so active giant spider was not covered by insurance, plus no Geico. When our heroes trip into a web and meet the star of this show, everyone else is pretty skeptical until he pays a visit to their town. He was probably just traveling to Area 51, and this whole thing was a misunderstanding. Seriously, I did like it. Though the lead actress seemed a little too fixated on gift bracelets dropped in the very dangerous cave right until the end, but the spider was a pretty one, and the effects and performances were solid. There was a semi-bloody scene for the car accident right out of the gate for that early movie jump scare. Day 5's theme is animals, and I chose 1976's Grizzly. I first read the movie poster caption as 18 feet of towering furry, as opposed to 18 feet of towering fury. I rank bears among my favorite animals, and run a group on Facebook called Modern Bearnanigans. This is devoted to the goings-on of bears hanging out in our modern society. Pretty much everything from a mama bear taking her cubs to a suburban pool, or a bird feeder, or a bear just hanging out at the door of a DJ in his home, who was streaming a live set on Twitch. This really happened, Asheville, North Carolina. The bear in this movie was not in the mood for dancing, but to be fair, house music and live streams were not much of a thing in 1976. After a few helicopter nature shots, we learn that a batch of park rangers are harried after learning that this weekend has the largest turnout of campers and backpackers the park has seen. Worse yet, a killer bear is on the loose, and Smokey is a slasher villain. There is plenty of cannon fodder who will say they'll be right back before the paws come out. There was even a scene where a woman showers in a waterfall, unaware of the bear watching and later attacking. Only you can prevent forest maulings. Nathan from the I Hope You Suffer podcast informed me that there is a sequel, and that bear needs a hockey mask. Just saying. Day 6's theme focuses on horror movies from Italy, and I chose 1987's Enigma. I guess you gotta love The Revenge of the Bullied. This is a Lucio Fulci film, so this should be as weird as it is 80s. It begins at an all-girls boarding school with a boy and a girl helping dress a rather stiff-looking girl for a date. When I first saw this, I thought they were dressing up a mannequin, but this is a real girl getting dressed for a real date with an older-looking man who turns out to be a teacher at that school. I guess she thought they were going to go dancing, but they end out at a make-out spot where the creepy-ass teacher comes on to the girl, who's into it until she finds out this was being recorded and the friends were listening in on another group of popular kids. This teacher, her date, who is way too comfortable with the all-teenage girl student body, was in on this prank too. See, this was an exclusive school. and this girl was the daughter of the housekeeper and therefore a target. Naturally, she runs off humiliated, her laughing tormentors giving chase through the woods until she ends up on the road and getting hit by a car. Now, those bullies probably assumed that with this girl now comatose, they were in the clear. But something picks them off one by one, and it is nasty. Enter a new girl with a spotty memory of where she grew up. Was it a rich family from Boston or a rich family from New Orleans? Who knows? And a penchant for channeling pissed off coma patients and coming on to the doctor treating her. Fulci delivers when it comes to eerie atmosphere, and it is put to good use, both in the antagonist's initial struggle to live after the accident, and the vengeance later wreaked. Whether it's death by a million snails or a painting that bleeds and chops off an arm, he can do some crazy horror sequences. I was very bothered by the doctor and the male teacher coming onto the girls at the all-girls school. That doctor was at least 35 and the male teacher 30 if a day. Come on. Day 7's theme was made for TV, and I chose 1970's How Awful About Alan, an Aaron Spelling production. This film features Anthony Perkins, who I like a lot behind the Beyond the Psycho franchise. Mahogany, anyone? Perkins plays Alan, who's staying with his unbalanced sister and her tenant, quote-unquote, after a stint in a mental hospital. The movie starts with a fire. Alan is unable to help his father, who dies, or help his sister, whose face is burned. Alan ends up with psychosomatic blindness. You come to learn that he accidentally set the fire by way of paint cans near a heater, and Alan's doctor tries to help him reconcile the resentment and jealousy of the father overall and the closer father-daughter relationship involving his sister. And you gotta love the woman patient yelling to Alan that he'll be back as he's being discharged. If you want made-for-TV fare, this has it. Anthony Perkins gives a good performance, and there is melodrama, side plots, romance, car accidents, and poor Alan not knowing who to trust as the voices get louder and the incidents get weirder. It did get convoluted, and the twist at the end was what I had a feeling it would be. But it was an okay watch, even if it reinforced how typecast Perkins was after Psycho, albeit in a character who was more like Norman Bates of Psycho 2. Day 8's theme is Christopher Young, the composer, and I chose 2020's The Empty Man. Movies about cults tend to get my attention, and I wanted to see this when it first came out. It starts out in Bhutan in 1995, and pretty eerily so, as a group of hikers pass by odd knickknacks on their trail. One was jumping a little too excitedly when they reached the rickety bridge. I love the outdoors. I love trails. I fear bridges. I freak out over hanging bridges that are festooned with bells for some reason. Scare out of the gate? Okay, I like this already. Needless to say, distant whistling, a fall into a cave, and encountering found remains ensure things will bode poorly for this group. Carrying their fallen, hypnotized, possibly comatose friend to the creepy cabin might seem like a good idea, but not in horror movie land where there are no phones and a snowstorm. Cut to 2018 Missouri. To a man that used to be a cop now working at a security store. He's celebrating his birthday alone until he uses a coupon for a free birthday meal. The man only wanted to pay for the tequila shots. However, the waitstaff sings to him as he cashes his coupon, alerting everyone nearby that he is alone on his birthday with a cruddy-looking free-for-a-reason cake. I'll note that when my birthday does not fall on a weekend, I will celebrate alone. After work, with office cake, like a proper adult. It is the little things in life. After the free cake, the daughter of one of his friends checks in on him, as his wife and son had died recently. She also talks of a group that helped with her own depression, and just disappears, leaving our former cop to take on the case and find more weirdness set to the musical stylings and effects of Christopher Young, who had also composed for Copycat, another favorite movie of mine. The trail leads to a secret society with a thing for tulpas. These are entities created by spiritual mental powers, and this is led by Stephen Root, who spoke about the Empty Man, but did not ask about his stapler or set the building on fire during this sermon-like speech, thankfully. And friends who recount the Empty Man legend of blowing into an empty bottle found on a bridge to summon him. I wouldn't blow into empty bottles I find anyway, as they are possibly riddled with dirt and crap, particularly on a bridge. Why this missing girl and her friends did it for a gag, I'll never know, but it wasn't germs that got them. This is a slow burn movie. The weather is atmospheric as the music, as much mystery as it was urban legend, superstition, horror. This one played on the bridge fears, and you might jump at a shadow and drink from a cleaned and recyclable can after this. Day 9's theme is devoted to the blog Bleeding Skull. Participants are encouraged to pick a movie reviewed on it, and I chose 1957's Daughter of Dr. Jekyll. Before the title screen, I am treated to a disclaimer that Cheesy Videos tried to provide the best remaster of this film possible, and apologize for any glitches. Thank you, Cheesy Videos, and thank you, Tubi. The title screen announces a recap of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but Hyde was a werewolf. And when he died, the town is relieved. No more danger. A man in bad wolf makeup and a big tooth gives a high cackling, "Are you sure?" Alright, that was pretty funny. The attempt at gothic horror went downhill from there. It had melodrama, superstition, gaslighting, and stories of Jekyll dying by way of stake through the heart. I've seen better. Now, Day 10's theme is Hail Satan. And I chose 1973's Satan's School for Girls. Holy devil balls, it's another Aaron Spelling made for TV production. But this time around, our story takes place at a women's fine art school infiltrated by a girl looking for answers after her sister is found dead in their home. The movie starts with a young woman speeding her way down a winding dirt road until she reaches a payphone. Yes, those existed back then. Desperately dials a number and, not reaching anyone, sees a creepy-looking man, forcing her to race back to her car, speed some more, and when she reaches the house, she does not find her sister, but a figure off-camera and doom. From there, her suspicious sister finds her way to the roommate, then this exclusive school, and friends that really like to offer her booze. Turns out, this fine arts academy that stayed on the same spot under many names for 300 years is a front for a satanic cult. Look, just because he's the devil, it does not mean he doesn't appreciate the arts and well-rounded students. Well, until said students start to stray from tradition. But I blame the headmistress and cult for a lot of that. As this amateur investigation continues, there are more deaths in the student body, and weird occurrences such as secret rooms with creepy people, psych professors who really like the allegories of rat mazes, and a lot of thunderstorms. I was a little more perturbed by the male painting professor hosting wine parties to the young women's students than any satanic presence. Day 11's theme is devoted to horror movies from Mexico, and I chose 1957's El Vampiro. With a vampire as the lead antagonist, this was more gothic and effective shot in black and white. It begins with a woman starting to get ready for bed, but has a bad feeling something's at the window. She's right, a well-dressed and brooding man is in her courtyard and just staring. Staring until he figures that he's going to have to just turn into a bat to bite this woman, as she wasn't going to, you know, go down and confront him right there in that courtyard. Impatient little buggers, these vampires. Cut to a young woman heading back to her childhood village, only to find one aunt dead and something off with the other one, who doesn't seem to age, cast a reflection, and, well, that village is a little weird too. Afraid of one Count Carol de Lavaud. Turns out, the good count is out for blood in more ways than one. You can see the influence of Dracula, right down to a special delivery of dirt from the home country, but it was a cool precursor to Hammer films that came out later on, and seen as the beginning of a boom of horror movies in Mexico during the 1960s. It was a very good beginning, with a little cheesy lighting, but solid performances and atmosphere for days. Day 12's theme is Scarecrow and I chose Husk. This was a remake of a movie made in 1988 called Scarecrows. Husk was made in 2011. I'm guessing the phone lines were cut off, if available in the original. For Husk, I had a feeling that cell phone service was non-existent. Which is too bad, as our story starts with a murder of crows. See what I did there? These badass Corvids derail an SUV, and the friend group inside are only unconscious after the ensuing accident. Well, save for the guy that ends up missing, then undead and sewing. In the meantime, a little boy is seen, and the one girl in the group chases after him only to find the remains under a scarecrow. Hallucinations, freaky cornfields, and all sorts of scarecrow mayhem follow. I hate scarecrows about as much as I hate puppets as a horror villain, as they creep me out when I turn off my TV. If you know me, you know that I knit dolls, and my creations include various horror characters. Maybe it's because I never made that scarecrow, but I don't like them at Michael's, I don't like them at Target, and I didn't like them at that haunted house attraction. Weirdly enough, as creepy as scarecrows are, they don't always star in very good movies. Husk was what I expected from the set of After Dark films, After Dark originals. Scarecrow Gone Wild plain sucked, and I will not watch the original Scarecrows if I can help it. Now, Guillermo del Toro gave Harold the Scarecrow one hell of a star turn in Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, but the best part of Husk was the crows. The crows need their own movie. Day 13's theme is devoted to horror movies from the 1980s, and I chose 1987's The Unnameable. Every time that I think that I've seen every horror movie from the 1980s, I am proven wrong on many levels, and I'm okay with this. I got to watch a Lovecraftian creature locked up in a room within an abandoned house wreak havoc within that same house when released. I'm sure this monster just needed a trip to the mall, maybe the makeup counter. Either way, this is based on an H.P. Lovecraft story. The description said a modern take, even though it begins in the 1600s. Cut to a house and a man with a wailing secret in that house. Our man unlocks the door to its cell like you would open the door to your meowing cat. Since this is a demon and not a kitty who will just, you know, go in and out of the room once the door is open, the warlock's throat gets ripped open. Because this man was a warlock, the house is abandoned and people were wondering if he should be buried in quote-unquote sacred ground. Okay. Cut to the modern take of our program set at Miskatonic University in New England. The town is unspecified, but I will guess any little town between Boston and Providence. While this university probably shouldn't have been accredited in any way due to the monsters and all other cultish derring do accompanying such tales, the campus seems to have a well-to-do student body, rejected Yale's, I don't know, and out of these students, we are treated to a very unlikable cast. We have the Miskatonic scholar, who argues with an equally pretentious science major about the merits of a legend involving an unnameable demon causing insanity near the house where they're all hanging out. They are joined by their follower of a friend who is undecided whether to join the scientist who sent tries to spend the night at this creepy house, where he's later decapitated, or the scholar. Well, he makes the wise choice and joins the scholar when he sees the girl that he likes, and the girl he follows everywhere while ignoring a plainer friend who likes him for some reason. when our scientist doesn't return, our follower is concerned. Meanwhile, the two girls are approached by two frat boys trying to trick them into sex and to take them to the creepy demon house to do it. Wailing Demon has none of it and starts clawing asshole co-heads. Until the scholar, who doesn't seem to care about his friends, summons tree spirits. There were a lot of shaking branches that finally slew this monster that didn't get enough screen time. There were very good makeup effects for the monster, but you only get to see it for a couple of scenes, even as they're clawing people. I really wish they killed that entire group, as they were fucking obnoxious. Day 14's theme is horror movies directed by women, and I chose 2012's Kiss of the Damned, directed by Alexandra Zan Cassavetes. This was a fun enough and enjoyable vampire movie, with very pretty leading actors, including Mila Ventimiglia as a human screenwriter who spies a very pretty woman in a video store. Yes, you heard right, video store. And they were still around in 2012. I lived near one in Hamden, Connecticut, called Best Video before moving to Texas. The two very pretty film buffs spy one another, and after a few push-and-pull love scenes, our screenwriter is now a live-in vampire companion. I couldn't help but wonder how this woman vampire fell in love with this guy after a day or so and had him move into her mansion, but this is a movie, and he is very pretty. Trouble in paradise brews when her sister moves in, as she is destructive and manipulative. I was struck by how gruesome her scenes were when she picked up people for some blood-drinking action. Overall, I had some fun with this. Did I mention the leads were very pretty? Day 15's theme is Hong Kong, and I chose 2015's Ouija 4, originally titled Dipson Dipson. I was considering this for sequels, but I wanted to go with Final Destination 3. But still, I was interested when I learned that the setup for this involved playing with a Ouija board, but online, as opposed to digging through your closet to find the board game, which could be scarier than the game itself, depending upon how organized your home is. Our cast are a group of business partners in an online game company in danger of going under until a woman approaches them to finish and launch the online game of her dead son. It involved Ouija boards, and if it sounded a little shady, don't worry, a lot of money is involved. More than enough to cover the act of ghosts and other weirdness, right? Well, their vices, be it gambling, sex, married men, or most notably drunk driving, come back to haunt them. I was expecting to see more of the haunted app itself, but the characters use the physical board, and the story plays out more as revenge haunting. It was okay, but it got a little bit convoluted. And thus ends part one of this two-part episode of the Bad Movie Bunny podcast. If you'd like to get more content from me, you can visit my blog at www.badmoviebunnies.com or find me on Twitter or Facebook as Bad Movie Bunnies. But before I bounce, here's a few words from the Prescribed Films Podcast Network. Thanks again, and check them out.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal, providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.